tell you about this afternoon are two models that we've been developing in the group for simulating biological membranes and lipid bilayers over length and time scales beyond what you would typically be able to do with, for example, fully atomic approaches like molecular dynamic simulation. And we've, you know, to a certain extent, seen a lot of this already, so I think I'm going to try to keep the background somewhat more limited than I had anticipated. Basically, the idea, so the first model I'll be telling you about is sort of elastic level description for looking at the dynamics of fluctuating bilayers. And in the second part of the talk, I'll describe a model to you that's very similar to what Mark has described on Monday. If there is a connection between these two, and it's what I tried to put in the summary that I sent to IPAM, is that we're sort of explicitly not considering solving in the dynamics of these systems. We're considering it implicitly over here in the sense that we have the hydrodynamics taken into account in a similar way that we've already seen discussed, and I'll say something about that. And over here, we've got water taken into account by means of effective potentials of mean force that are holding the bilayer together. All right, so, I mean, I think Marcus and other people have done a pretty nice job of motivating why you want to have some sort of simple simulation models to study systems. I'm a chemist, so usually when I go to chemistry departments, people want to see me put up a picture with one of these fully atomic, nice MD simulations. And so I thought I'd go through this slide just because I think it's illustrative of what MD can and can't do for you in the present day. So if you look in the literature, the chemistry literature, the biophysics literature, you can find really no end of molecular dynamic simulations to read about. And I picked this one sort of more or less at random. The authors themselves made the comment in the conclusion that the simulation was only possible because of, quote, recent advances in computer architecture and algorithmic advances in simulation techniques. So I think this is maybe not the biggest MD simulation on record, but it's sort of in the range of things you can do these days, practically speaking. And this was a paper out of Scott Feller's group. They looked at a single rhodopsin protein with a modestly sized bilayer composed of 100 lipids, 25 cholesterol molecules, and enough water to solvate the thing. And that ends up already being, you know, pretty big, about 50,000 atoms, and the linear dimension of a system like this is in the range of about 10 nanometers, so around 10 nanometers cubed. And what made this a fairly large simulation by present day standards is how long they ran it for. So they ran it for over 100 nanoseconds, which is sort of atypical these days. Most people run things for maybe tens of nanoseconds at most. So, okay, so that's what you can do, or I'm going to claim that that's what you can do, and if there's, I guess Gary is gone, so I don't think anybody's going to argue with me too much. You might be able to do an order of magnitude bigger than this, but not much more than that. Okay, so, you know, compare these numbers to what you'd like to be able to look at, right, a whole cell or some significant fraction thereof, and you're talking about a huge disparity in length scales and also time scales. I would argue that sort of a relevant time scale for something biologically interesting to happen would be at least millisecond times, and that's, you know, obviously quite a bit bigger than this. So if you're really optimistic about how you could get your MD simulation to scale, you might see, well, we'll just scale linearly with the size, the number of atoms in the system, with the linear dimension of the system. And so if you thought about doing a simulation that was perhaps a micron by a micron with enough room in the z direction to solvate the thing and allow for fluctuations in the membrane surface and allowed it to run for a millisecond, you can convince yourself, again, assuming this linear scaling, that this is about 2 billion times bigger than this state-of-the-art calculation up here. So I think most of us in this day and age have become sort of numb to numbers like this associated with computation because people say, well, you know, computers are getting faster all the time, and, you know, so what? But I mean, 2 billion is a big number, really, no matter what, right? I mean, even if you believe that Moore's law is going to continue indefinitely into the future, you know, you say, well, computers are getting twice as fast every year and a half. Okay, so, you know, I'll be retired by the time you can do this. So, you know, and I'm an assistant professor, right? So this is not a, it's, I mean, I wouldn't place any bets on being able to run a fully atomic MD simulation to answer really cellular biology sort of questions in the future. So there is sort of a need for much more simplified strategies, and we've seen a number of such things right here. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you about, as I said, are these two models we've been developing, and I'll tell you a little bit about the methodology, although we've seen the math to a large extent already, so I'll try to keep that to a minimum. And I'm going to present this first model in the context of the problem that got us interested in this sort of simulation technique, and that's looking at the motion, diffusive motion of proteins on the surface of red blood cells. And I'll say just a bit about some more modern, not more modern, but historically more modern to us, things we've been doing more recently. And then I'll move on to the second part of the talk where I'll discuss this flexible model that is a molecular level resolution to it. And assuming there's time, I may say a little bit about how we were motivated by this simplified model to sort of rethink some of the analytical theory. And I think that that's really one of the strengths of sort of this level of simulation, is that you can get results and this will sort of inspire you to think a little bit more about the theories that are out there. And it's a little bit easier to move between simplified model and theory than it is to go from, you know, fully atomic MD in theory or directly between experiment and theory. So the starting point of the simulations are things we've already heard about, basically Helfrich energetics for a membrane sheet. And so we're going to parameterize within the Monge gauge, and I'll apologize to Jamal right now for our sort of pedestrian approach to this problem. And we're going to do this at lowest order, so we're just going to go ahead and keep things at order h squared in there. And so we've seen this several times already, right? We have a curvature term here, which says it costs energy to locally put bends in the membrane, and the amount of energy it costs is going to depend on the constant that's sitting in front of that, and then you have to integrate over the surface of the sheet. And if you want to, you could stick a surface tension term in there as well as eventually any other potentials. But for the moment, I just want to focus on the simplest possible case. If you don't like dealing with the continuous representation, you can say, well, let's look at the normal modes of this system, so we'll Fourier transform it, and then we can write things, depending on your point of view, a little bit more simply. The Fourier modes really are quite a bit more simple if you start asking questions about the dynamics. So if we look at overdamped dynamics in this system, and I'll say more about this on the next slide, you have an equation of motion for each one of these modes individually, all right, these really are the normal modes of the system, which says that the amplitude of each of these Fourier modes evolves with the Langevin type equation with a damping coefficient, which scales as the cubed of the Fourier wave vector. We've seen that result already, but I'll say just a bit about it on the next slide. So the point is, this equation is a simple equation. What does it do? It says on average, things relax back to being flat, no amplitude. There's thermal fluctuations around that, so that's a thermal white noise term, Gaussian white noise term, and temperature is wrapped up in there. So the magnitude of the fluctuations depends on how hot the system you're running. And that's a simple enough equation, it's well known. The solutions to it in a probabilistic sense, this is just the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process, so you can actually say, probabilistically, what's the probability at a given temperature that a given one of these modes has a certain amplitude. All right, that's just Gaussian in the magnitude of the fluctuations. And beyond that, you can answer questions about the dynamics. And the whole process is Gaussian because of the nature of this random force. And you can say, so what's the conditional probability that if you start with a given amplitude at time zero, that you're some other amplitude at a time t later? And again, that's just some Gaussian thing here. So you can pull these numbers randomly out of the computer to give you a simulation algorithm, if you like. Or if you ask a simple enough question, you can actually deal with this model analytically. Okay, but it's just important to remember it is, Roland said 2 days ago now, right, you have this intermingling here of elasticity, fluctuations, and dynamics, which makes for sort of an interesting story.
In that kind of a situation, I mean, the obvious thing you could calculate is the inelastic neutron scattering or something.
Yeah, analytically, yeah.
What do you do about, there's some delicate stuff about the boundary conditions.
So here, because we're thinking about doing this in a simulation format, I'm going to assume everything's periodic. I should have said that.
Okay. So it's really infinite.
Yeah, infinite but repeating itself. Okay, and anyway, the constants that come into play here, if you actually want to do something with this, right, the bending modulus of the membrane, the size of the periodic simulation box, temperature, which is wrapped up into this random force, and the viscosity of the cytoplasm, which rears its head, or cytoplasm, or whatever the fluid is around this thing, which shows up in the decay of the modes here, and how that comes into play, I think we've seen three times now, so I'll go through it somewhat quickly. But the starting point here is we say, well, we've got this membrane, it's existing in a fluid. If that fluid is infinite, we can say, well, if we start imposing a force at a given point in the space over here, how is that going to affect somewhere else in the fluid? Well, that decays actually rather slowly. It decays like 1 over r. So you can essentially solve for the behavior of the fluid in the Stokes limit, low Reynolds number limit, and it tells you that the behavior for a point where we'll think about the velocity of the fluid right at the membrane surface right now is dependent upon the force at all the other points on the membrane surface, and those forces would come from, for example, the fact that the membrane doesn't want to be bent and is trying to flatten out. But that's going to be a non-local effect, which is going to propagate over all space. So the membrane's being poked over here, for example, and it's not only moving up right above the pointer, but it's being influenced everywhere else because of this Ossing-tensor interaction that we've heard about now several times. So this equation, okay, depending on your point of view, it's either looks pretty bad or not, but I think if you're going to deal with this computationally, you don't like to deal with convolutions. If you're dealing with it analytically, you don't want to either. So the trick you use in this geometry is just to take the Fourier transform, and then your life becomes much easier. K to the fourth comes from the four derivatives in the bending energy we saw. 1 over K is the Fourier transform of this kernel in here that goes like 1 over R. And we have the Fourier transform of this random force. So anyway, the point I wanted to make is that, you know, this is really the place where this K cubed comes from. Four factors from the derivatives and one from,
Frank, the noise you had before is U from K, but now you have a noise from K. So.
The noise I had before was...
You just held up, you didn't have any indices in there.
Well, this is as a function of position.
This, I mean, the previous slides that...
Well, I probably made an error. Oh, no. These are, okay, so I should have a K there. Absolutely.
So you want to
Yeah. How did you see that? Or remember?
Can you remember this? I'm just wondering. Mathematicians.
I mean, if it was in front of you, I would understand, but I'm going to have to be careful. Okay, so, you know, it turns out that particular form of the kernel in there, which looked like 1 over K with the viscosity, you can actually generalize that for somewhat more general hydrodynamic environments. And still get analytical solutions out. You can treat, for example, the case of different viscosities on either side of the membrane where you would just replace the viscosity with the average of the two. You can consider cases where you have the membrane fluctuating next to a wall. This can be pertinent to some, perhaps not biological systems, but systems done on the solid support, or a variation on that where you have some sort of semi-permeability, and look at various combinations of these things. And the point is that you can get these kernels to tell you how the thing reacts non-locally from the forces you apply at any given set of points. And you can then, although they might be a hassle when you think about some combination of two different viscosities and a wall to deal with that analytically, if you put this into a simulation algorithm, it's not such a big deal. It's a complicated expression, but the computer deals with it quite easily. Okay, so this is just to give you an idea of the sort of things you would do. So again, you know, at this level you can get analytical answers, but it's sort of nice to see what this looks like in terms of a fluctuating sheet. So the dimensions here are about 100 nanometers by 100 nanometers. The Z dimension's been blown up to emphasize the fluctuations. These fluctuations never get as high as really 10 nanometers, which is the top of the square. And the loop is going to run now for half a microsecond and then disappear. I thought I had fixed that.
So you're solving
that is
equations in Fourier space and then inverse Fourier transform.
At the end of the day, yeah, when we want to plot it, we go back. So in practice, what I did here was we just pulled random numbers from a Gaussian distribution. And it gives us a time.
For each time, so that's okay.
Yeah.
Because you have an analog.
That's all right. That's right, up to this point, yeah.
So this transformation from the real space to the Fourier space, we just get a bunch of uncoupled oscillators. That only really works for free membrane. You have constraints on the membrane and all the modes.
Yeah, well, hold on.
Oh, okay.
So simplest possible case.
Can you run that again?
Can I? I hope so.
I like to see things moving around the bunch of equipment.
I can put on a continuous loop for you. So anyway, so the numbers I've used here are those for the red blood cell membrane. So the point is that over these sorts of dimensions, if you don't have any tension, where it's about 100 nanometers, the fluctuations are on the order of less than 10 nanometers.
And the lateral scale of the?
That was 100 nanometers, 500. Wow. So, I mean, there's really no limit. I mean, I could have shown you a meter by a meter if I wanted to. I mean, it's a simple enough data. It's not an issue.
is the limpet part 4 to 5 nanometers, 3 nanometers, whatever it is, over 100. So that's the scale, right? The thickness.
The thickness, yeah. So the thickness, which we treat as being infinitely thin, is on this scale, you might be able to see something that looked like a pencil.
Yeah.
It does, yeah. I mean, if it's not clear, it is periodic.
Okay.
If you're not picking up on that. Okay, so, I mean, like I said, this is all fairly well-known stuff, and our contribution has been to say, well, you know, there's really no reason why you can't extend this and start sticking potentials in there, especially if you want to think about doing this on a computer instead of on a piece of paper. And at a level of writing down the formalism, you can make things look, you know, almost exactly the same, where you sort of hide everything in whatever the form of this potential is. So you can still take a Fourier transform with this potential, and we'll just leave these functional brackets there to say it could be sort of anything. The dynamics will also work out the same, although now the forces are going to reflect not only the thing being bent and wanting to flatten back out, but also, you know, whatever I'm doing to it. If I'm poking it with the cytoskeleton or an AFM tip or whatever I want to do. And again, at the formal level, we can make this look almost the same as before, but, you know, we just wrapped up all the complications into some force here, which depends on the entire configuration of the membrane in general. And again, you know, depending on the hydrodynamic situation, you've just got some kernel there to multiply those forces. So there's really three possibilities. One, we sort of don't have any force here that's too complicated to just solve analytically, so what we've already seen. You could have something harmonic here, in which case you might be able to deal with that analytically, or you could have a harmonic model in a weird geometry, in which case there would still be normal modes to find, but it might not be clear how to do that, so you'd have to diagonalize some matrix on your computer, or you could have something here that was actually not quadratic, so you actually have to do a full-fledged simulation, okay, something that amounts to a Brownian dynamic simulation, and that's what I'm gonna mostly tell you about. And the sort of one conceptual point here is that these equations are still much easier to solve in Fourier space than the convolution in real space, because you don't have to deal with this convolution over space. And so you can do what amounts to a standard Brownian dynamic simulation on the evolution of these Fourier modes, go back to real space to evaluate the potential, sort of hop back and forth. I mean, this is sort of a somewhat standard thing that chemists do for other problems in quantum mechanics. So this gives us an efficient way to handle the hydrodynamics, and it also does something sort of good for us and allows us to coarse grain over short wavelength fluctuations if we don't know about what's going on there, because let's say, well, we're going to get rid of those Fourier modes. Okay, so the problem that sort of motivated this and I thought was most appropriate to discuss here because of the name of the program that we've looked at is the diffusion of proteins on the surface of cells, and in particular red blood cells. So the story here may be one that some of the more biologically minded people are familiar with, and we've seen pictures like this already in the workshop. The inside surface, the intracellular surface of the red blood cell, has this cytoskeletal network attached to it. It's anchored there with proteins that reside in the lipid bilayer, and so you have these sorts of, you know, triangular symmetry structure repeating itself over the surface of the red blood cell again and again and again. The implication this has for diffusion in the plane of the membrane is that if you look at really small length scales, okay, you can pick up on a diffusion constant within these regions. And I'm going to say something now that I sort of, in view of the last talk, probably shouldn't say, but you pick up on a diffusion constant that is sort of in agreement with what Safran and Delbrück would tell you. Okay, so maybe Safran and Delbrück is crap, but I mean, this is sort of the number you expect for a protein in a bilayer, and the magnitude of this thing is about right if you look at artificial lipid systems. And actually, you can take an enzyme, get rid of the cytoskeleton here, and you'll see sort of the bulk diffusion gives you this number. And these experiments were done where they could actually see movement at this length scale with single protein tracking measurements. Anyway, there's a short length scale diffusion random walk, which is happening within these diffusion constant about 5 × 10⁻⁹ square centimeters per second. But the more traditional measurements people will do, like FRAP, when people looked at the surface of the red blood cell years ago, would give a number that was about 100 times smaller than this. And so what's going on is that the protein is sort of jittering around in here, Brownian motion, but it's hitting these walls and not getting out. And occasionally, something happens and allows it to get next door, and this can happen again and again. And so this hopping between regions on the surface of the cell, these regions, I'll call them corrals, gives rise to sort of a hop diffusion, which you would pick up on in a macroscopic measurement, which is about two orders of magnitude smaller than what you see happening microscopically. So having the spectrum there is slowing the diffusion of the proteins down considerably. So qualitatively, at this level, people understand what's happening, but being a chemist and a physical chemist, you're always concerned about reaction mechanisms or mechanisms in general, what's allowing this to happen.
Question.
Yeah.
Has this been seen for a lot of proteins, or is there a particular
protein? So the particular protein they look at here is band 3. It's the protein that exchanges CO2 out of the red blood cell. Basically, what's important is that you have a domain that sticks down here far enough to bump into this stuff. If you cleave
but
off that domain.
So,
so they've done the experiment. I mean, they haven't systematically altered that. We'd like to see that, but if they chop it off completely, the thing is essentially unaffected by this. So if you look in the literature, the people that do these experiments and to a limited extent some theory that's been done, the mechanism that's proposed for allowing the protein to ever be able to escape from its confinement within one of these regions at all is typically some sort of dynamic reorganization of the cytoskeleton. So the spectrum network is either breaking apart and getting out of the way, which allows the protein to sort of get through these barriers, or you have a thermal fluctuation of the spectrum so that it bends out of the way enough to let the protein go over the top. And I'm not going to say anything today to really try to dispute that, but what we got interested in trying to consider was just a different possibility, which is that this protein up here, it's a lousy rendering, but the idea is that you can imagine something sort of somewhat like what's happening here, but that it's the lipid bilayer that's doing the moving. Okay, so the bilayer can bend and fluctuate out of the way, and if it bends far enough, the bottom of this thing is going to be able to get over the top of the spectrum cytoskeleton. So that's what we wanted to look at. And so, you know, why? I think basically just because it, you know, seemed interesting to us, something that was not really considered in the literature at all. All the focus has been on the dynamics of the spectrum. We've seen a number of slides already where we've actually seen in movies of microscopy fluctuations of lipid bilayers, so we know that these sorts of effects are there, at least on longer length scales, and if you believe elasticity theory, those things should propagate down to the sort of tens of nanometers relevant to this problem. And so what's really nice about this from a theorist perspective is all the numbers we're going to have to shove into this we can get from measurements that have nothing to do with protein diffusion, or for the most part have nothing to do with protein diffusion. So this isn't going to come down to a game of us fitting a bunch of stuff at the end of the day. We have numbers, we put them in, and either the model works or it doesn't, and we're not, you know, playing games or trying to get it to work. So anyway, this is me just trying to be as clear as possible. So what I'm suggesting is you have this red protein is diffusing around within these regions, and I'm saying, well, if we don't allow the spectrum to move, and I'm not claiming that's the case, I'm saying let's just focus on a different issue, that the only way this thing is going to be able to escape is if some sort of fluctuation, the bilayer occurs that's big enough and lasts long enough to allow the red thing to diffuse over the top. And these are the numbers that go in there that come from other studies on red blood cells, flicker effect type studies, cytoplasm inside the red blood cell, length scale of these corrals, body temperature. This is the microscopic diffusion constant that we said you can see happening microscopically. H naught is the depth that these band 3 proteins protrude into the cell. Okay, so that's known from. So to model this, the potential that we add on top of just this bending energetics has to account for the interaction with the cytoskeleton. And we've got two pieces here. Number one, we say, well, the membrane has to be pinned to this network. And that's what we've got happening here. So we've just got a strong harmonic pinning constraint that keeps the membrane localized at the points where the anchors sit. And then we have to take into account that the membrane, as it's fluctuating up here, it's not going to be able to get beneath the spectrum. So we've got a repulsive interaction between the spectrum and the membrane. And, you know, in absence of any better information to the contrary, we just use a hydration potential. So something that's just steep and relatively hard to keep these things from hitting one another. These delta functions just say it's only pinned where there's anchors at a point in space, and the repulsive interaction only acts between the segments where the cytoskeleton lies. movie. So this is a movie, this is not really going to run long enough for you to see anything interesting happening, but the geometry of the simulation, you see the red dots here, these are the anchors between the membrane and the spectrum, so you can see they're not moving anywhere because we're not letting them. You should see red filaments here between the red dots, which are the spectrum filaments, okay, and you'll notice that the membrane in between these points never gets below flat, right? That's because the spectrum is preventing it from doing so, although it can go below flat in these regions that are away from the edges, okay, and that does happen. Okay, so anyway, this thing only ran, I think it only ran for half a microsecond, and to really see sort of this thing going down and coming up somewhere else, you have to run for sort of tens of microseconds, and the movie doesn't look good if you take much larger time instead.
Does square, triangular lattice matter?
So we ran both, and it doesn't really make a difference. So what do we extract from those simulations? What we want to know is we want to know how often a hole opens up at the edge of these regions that allows the protein to diffuse out. Okay, so we collect statistics here on these thermal fluctuations. We ask how often is it that a gap opens up that's big enough for the protein to slip out, and if that gap does open up, what's the probability that persists long enough that the protein would have a chance to diffuse over it? And then on that basis, that gives us essentially a rate constant or an escape probability at the edge of the corral, which you can turn into an escape probability from the corral as a whole, and turn this into a random walk on a lattice between these individual corrals, which gives you diffusion, okay, the diffusion that you would measure in a macroscopic measurement. And anyway, so that's what we collect with these statistics. We're not explicitly simulating the diffusion of the protein on the membrane surface, but we're sort of calculating the probability that if there were a protein there, it would have a chance to escape. And then we can compare that macroscopic diffusion coefficient with what they measure in experiments. So we can do the simulations lots of different ways. And basically, the one to think this is sort of the best, so we've used the real triangular geometry, although it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. You can see that, you know, sort of a small prefactor. We've run the simulation large enough such that there's no finite size effects here. Okay, so we actually run these with like 16 or 25 corrals, so it doesn't matter, making it bigger, you don't get a different answer. And the number to compare to, so this 10 to the minus 10 square centimeters per second, the experimental value is about, it's within a factor of 3 is the same. And given, you know, the level of modeling we've put in here, this is sort of way better than we actually could have hoped for. So, you know, we're not going to claim that this is right, this is the mechanism that's happening, but what it does suggest is that these fluctuations of the membrane surface appear to be able to give rise to, you know, something in the right ballpark for the diffusion that's seen. So this idea that you're going to attribute everything to the dynamics of the cytoskeleton, you know, doesn't really seem to be the whole story in our estimation.
But is that, could you understand that in terms of a barrier? You just get a number that will tell you very much.
The way
I would have thought about that, I would have said, okay, there's a certain, using Helfrich, there's a certain probability for that kind of a fluctuation between these mid sites, and a certain energy that takes, and I would say that it's just the microscopic diffusion constant times e to the minus, you know.
Yeah, but the problem is it's a dynamic problem, so that hole has to open up long.
Well, I know, that's why I said, but if you use that, how does that give you, is that the right answer or not?
No, because actually, most of the time, if you just ask what's the probability that something opens up that's big enough, it's open a lot of the time. The thing that really cuts it down is that it's not open for very long. The hole, right?
That's what I want to find out, yeah.
Yeah, so the thing that really cuts down on the ability of the thing to escape is the fact that the fluctuations are occurring a little bit too fast.
Can you reproduce temperature dependency behavior of business?
We can certainly put temperature in the model. But if you start screwing with the temperature in the cell, I mean, you know, God knows what it's going to change other than the fluctuations of the bio there. So we really haven't played that game.
Could I just ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
What would the difference in area be between the bio and the spectrum network?
The difference in area.
In order to get these fluctuations at this kind of scale. I mean, that is my own idea.
What do you mean by area?
Well, there's an area for the spectrum,
yeah,
of the network, and then there's an area, there's an amount of membrane projected area.
That's an
effective tension.
Right? The network effectively puts a tension on the bilayer.
Yeah, but does the area of the bilayer match the area of the
spectrum? No, and that's what I'm saying. The network puts an effective tension. You have a non-zero, usually you have a
sure, over
sigma,
a long length scale.
Sigma Q
no, I mean, look, within this model, right? right?
Yes,
within
you have
the,
a non-zero signal.
No, within this model, we've actually got an infinite surface tension over long length scales, right? Because I am not allowing the membrane to move away from these red points. So observed from far away, this thing is flat. So the tension is infinite. Now that's wrong. We ought to be allowing these red things to move up and down. But for the local question I'm asking about a gap between here and here, it's irrelevant to us that these things are sort of globally moving, that the whole thing on this scale is moving.
Yeah, but you have to have a certain amount of stored fluctuations. I think that's what he's worried
stored
about.
Fluctuations in what?
Well, I mean, if it was really flat, then there wouldn't be any fluctuations at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of an NPT, two-dimensional, right? Those boundaries would move, not just...
So you're unhappy with the fact that I'm pulling extra area into the membrane?
He's just asking how...
There's a conjugate pressure there.
Yeah,
stress.
I guess it's...
No, well, there's no tension on the membrane. At these length scales, it doesn't matter.
And the issue is, like, we should be.
On longer length scales. And it comes from this. But at these length scales, well, I mean, maybe I'm not being clear.
Well, that might be right.
It is
right. Tension. That might be right. On a macro length scale, it's non-zero, but on this length scale.
Yeah.
So, I guess there's sort of two limits, right? One with a fixed cytoskeleton and a fluctuating membrane,
yeah.
Or a fixed membrane and a fluctuating cytoskeleton.
Yeah.
Has anyone tried to look at what it would do
no.
with a couple of
actually,
situations?
So we're starting to do that now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the problem is, yeah. We just haven't done that yet, so we're starting to look at that. So. Okay, so I'm running in a little bit later than I thought. I just wanted to point out that we can use this simulation methodology for other problems. Actually, the red blood cell work is sort of the older stuff we've been doing, and I hope that Jay would be here, but he left already. But we have been looking at his experiments. He didn't get a chance to talk about these on Tuesday, I guess. But basically, they can do some of these nice experiments where they take vesicles above a flat supported bilayer, cause it to rupture, and what they see is this upper bilayer come down and become pinned on localized adhesion sites to the supporting substrate. But on average, the thing stays under certain conditions quite a ways above the underlying surface, on the order of about 50 nanometers. So anyway, this is just showing you that we can model these sorts of systems as well. What we're looking at here is this upper bilayer. This is the experimental result. This is our simulations taking into account the finite resolution of the optical microscope, which you can see sort of modifies the actual details of what we think is happening in the actual simulation. And they also were able to measure fluctuations with these measurements, which we compare to as well as the dynamics, but I think I'll skip through this. And we can also use in here, there's no reason why we only have to have thermal fluctuating forces. We can have non-thermal forces. In particular, this was a case where we looked at light harvesting proteins in the surface of the membrane, which through their pumping activity or their shape change can change the properties of the membrane locally and cause the thing to move up and down. And we've been comparing to experimental work happening in France. Okay, so just to summarize this part, I'll just say that these well-known elastic models for membrane dynamical undulations can be extended without too much work to more complex geometries and more complex potentials if you're willing to do some simple-minded Brownian dynamic simulation. And we're able to show, or argue anyway, that these thermal undulations on the surface of the red blood cell appear to be able to promote protein mobility, the fusion constants that are actually measured. And you know, we think, and I showed you real quickly, that there are lots of other systems that are amenable to this sort of level of model, sort of Helfrich level energetics, thermal fluctuations, hydrodynamics included, but in geometries and potentials such that you really can't handle this quite analytically. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears now and say a little bit about this model, which is quite similar to the one that Marcus described on Monday. And so again, the idea here is that we're looking at a less coarse grain picture, obviously. We're not treating the membrane as an infinitely thin sheet in space. We're going to say, well, it actually has a structure associated with it, a molecular level structure, but we're going to take a very simplified view of what that molecular structure is. We just have some simple polymer model for each of the lipids, and they self-assemble into something that looks qualitatively like a bilayer. And again, the point I want to stress here is that we're doing this with simple pair potentials between the beads. Marcus gave a really nice sort of list of the models in this general sort of area and what's available. And I think his model and our model are sort of nice in the sense that they only have very simple potentials to deal with, and they get this behavior without explicitly simulating solvents. So that's the main point. And so there's a couple reasons why you want to do this. One is purely practical, right? If you want to study a bilayer, you want to be able to look at questions that perhaps are more complicated than what you can do with an elastic level of modeling that I've shown you already, but you don't want to run a fully atomic MD simulation, or you're unable to because of computer constraints, you should have something sort of in the middle. Elastic models, you're going to have problems with eventually if you want to think about treating very non-flat geometries or geometries that are not close to any simple reference shape, and particle-based models will likely enable you to do that. And again, you can sort of incorporate other things besides the membrane surface more realistically in models of this type. And I think one other thing that's interesting to us is that by looking at a model that's so simple that you've actually taken the water out of the simulation, it perhaps enables you to understand a little bit what's going on in terms of the bilayer stability. If you sort of understand something well enough to be able to fake it, you know, maybe you have a pretty good idea. So there's lots of different membrane models out there, and these were chosen not because I think these are necessarily the best works or the best publications, but because I think they give sort of a fair representation of proceeding from the very simple to the very complex, ranging from elastic models up to fully atomic molecular dynamics simulations. The model I'm going to tell you about, which is very similar in spirit to what Mark has told you about, falls around here, I think, in the scheme of things. So it differentiates itself from stuff appearing to this side, and that we actually preserve a molecular level of resolution, right? We have individual lipids in the simulation, but it differentiates itself from things occurring over here, and that we've gotten rid of the solvent, and of course, grained things down to a level that we're thinking of a lipid as just 5 beads on a chain with some flexibility associated. So, the motivation to our model, and this is sort of a hindsight motivation, this isn't exactly the way that we approached this from the beginning, but it's that we all sort of have a somewhat of a qualitative feeling about what's holding these things together. Okay, well, the hydrophobic effect is holding membranes together, and we've heard this said a number of times, and we know that that's an entropic effect, right? The waters don't want to order themselves around hydrophobic groups, and this gives rise to an interfacial tension between polar stuff up here somewhere and apolar parts down here. We're not going to be able to capture the full ramifications of the hydrophobic effect in a model where the solvent's not in there. It's an entropy-driven effect due to the behavior of the solvent. Okay, but what we probably can do, what I'm going to show you we can do, is that we can sort of mimic the effect of this interfacial tension by putting it in there by hand. Right? Now, if we change the temperature of the system, our results are going to be wrong, but at a given temperature, we can imagine trying to reproduce this interfacial tension artificially, and we're going to do that by putting a potential between beads on the lipids that are going to hold the system together. Okay, so the model looks like this. Basically, we have hydrophobic tails, which have simple Leonard-Jones interactions between them. We have polar heads, where we just keep the repulsive part of the Leonard-Jones interaction so they're not bumping into one another. What's sort of novel about the model is going on here between these beads, second beads in the chain, which we call the interfacial beads, and we have a potential there that is supposed to mimic the effects of this interfacial tension. It has a strange functional form. It looks like 1 over r squared. That's a 1 over r squared that gets truncated at 3 molecular diameters. So this actually looks qualitatively quite similar to the potential that Mark has showed you that they were using, looking at their interaction between chunks of lipids. What differentiates our model from Marcus's is that the only place we put this thing is between these beads at the interface. All right? He has this potential. If he had a 5-bead chain, it would be sort of acting between all of these. So as Marcus explained, if you only take repulsive parts in the heads and Leonard-Jones in the tails, you actually can't find a stable fluid phase. All right? And usually in biological systems, it's the fluid phase, liquid crystalline phase you're interested in. And so to get this to work, what you have to do is take potentials down here that are actually sort of weak enough. They won't hold the system together on their own, and then tune this longer range attraction here at the interface such that the system self-assembles and maintains fluidity in the sheet. And this is just to convince you that the things are stable, they'll self-assemble into a bilayer structure. I don't know why it ran so badly. Okay, so this is Monte Carlo. We're not running dynamics, so don't think of this as actual. All right, I apologize.
This is a pure abundance?
Yes. Yeah. So I don't understand why this is working. Anyway, it self-assembles into a bilayer from a random configuration. So we're convinced that it's stable. And oh yeah, then it instantaneously. All right, so I mean, you can of course get something we don't want, or at least we're not so interested in, which is a solid light phase, but at higher temperatures, it makes what I just showed you, which is something that does have fluidity in the plane of the membrane and elastic properties that are consistent with what you expect for real bilayer systems. So we were, I mean, that's what made us happy. We had a sort of a history with this problem, trying to use even more simplified models for the lipids to make bilayer structures. And what we found, so in that case, we used lipids that were just rigid rods, so something similar to the 5B chain, but without any flexibility. And the trouble we ran into was, yes, we could, if we worked very hard, get a system that self-assembled and was fluid-like, but the bending rigidity was way off. And this is essentially the cholesterol problem. If you put a bunch of cholesterol on the bilayer, the bending rigidity goes up. Well, if you use lipids that are essentially rigid cholesterol molecules, you get a rigidity that's too high. And if I had known a little bit more about this before we started, we probably wouldn't have taken that road. So anyway, it took us a while to arrive at this solution, but we're happy with the solution because the elastic constants that we get are in the range of what you want to see in real systems, both for the bending rigidity and the compressibility, and you can tune them over that range. And what I'm showing you here is only playing with the flexibility of the individual lipids. And so as we go from here to here, we're making the lipids more and more and more rigid. And as you can see, the bending rigidity of the membrane correspondingly goes up and up and up, just as you might expect.
What's that in KT? Epsilon is about KT.
So these numbers correspond to this, and these KT numbers are several KT. I think this epsilon is just about KT.
So in the motivation I pictured, you were showing the head group, sort of the phosphate group and head group sort of risen to the next like the molecule. Did that kind of ever happen in your model system?
I'm not. What are you?
You know the head, like, you know, phosphate group and whatever the charge group on the top.
Yeah.
If it's cooling group, they have the it's like enriching over.
That was an artifact. I mean, it's just something that the lowest energy configuration is completely straight in the heart. So we could certainly try to put that in there, but we haven't. So one thing that we're quite happy with in the model is that I think the reason we're getting the elastic constants right, Ka and Kc, is that we're actually doing a fair job of reproducing the distribution of stresses in the bilayer as you move from one side of the bilayer to the other. So for people that are familiar with this picture, what we're basically plotting here is the negative tension as you move from one side of the bilayer to the other. So if you're familiar with this, you know what you're looking at. If you're not, let me say the following. These deep troughs here are essentially telling you that it's these interfacial beads that are really holding the system together. They're trying to pull themselves together more tightly than they are. And what's preventing them from coming together more tightly is the fact that these repulsive guys, and to a more limited extent, the blue guys underneath them, aren't happy doing that. Okay, so the interfacial what we're calling the interfacial tension is the fact that these green guys are trying to hold the system together. And actually, if you integrate over this peak here, you get an interfacial tension that's in the range of about 30 to 50 millijoules per meter squared, which is what you would predict for the interfacial tension between water and oil. So we've sort of, at the mesoscopic level, we've got this stuff all more or less qualitatively right. If you compare this to a molecular dynamics simulation of a hydrated lipid bilayer, you have features that look similar. The comparison here is to a model that's actually almost identical to ours, but with the solvent in there. Okay, so they don't put in this interfacial attraction. They actually simulate water out there in a simplified way, and you see that the peaks are very similar. Actually, the correspondence is better than it appears here because I haven't scaled things quite right.
Is there any significance to the very deep, your deep methyl trough?
This?
Yeah.
Yeah, I.
Is it, experiments don't show that, you know?
They're not so deep.
Yeah.
You, well, I don't know that experiments show any of this, to my knowledge. I mean, you can get this out of MD simulations. And there may be indirect evidence to get at this from experiments, but I'm.
X-ray shows the neutral drop.
Yeah.
It shows the distribution of forces?
There's a little pip in the middle of it.
Well, this is forces, but.
Yeah, but this
is.
Also
density.
So I'm not showing you a density, yeah, I apologize. Yeah. So this, what this literally is showing you is I guess negative surface tension as a function of depth. So the tension is positive here, and negative on the other side. So I probably should show it density diagram.
Then the green is kind of squeeze a blue one too much inside the membrane.
You're saying this is too narrow?
No, I mean the green opposite is the blue one in the middle. Look at it. The green one kind of squeezed the blue bits of the middle too much compared to the one on the right.
I mean, the sugar.
So, okay, what I'm saying, you can't exactly, you're saying these two don't look exactly the same.
No, I mean, the qualitatively wrong is that the blue bits is squeezed too much into the middle. And
this is too deep. That's what he was saying, I think.
Yeah.
And so this is a little bit too deep, but in fully atomic molecular dynamics, it is there. Can be there. There's been maybe two, do you know how many MD studies of this? Two, maybe three in different groups. Okay, so anyway, the motivation we have for developing models is, although the project sort of took on a life of its own, just in trying to get a system that worked well, was that we wanted to look, of course, at inhomogeneous systems, either different species of lipids, to look at phase behavior, lipid rafts, or more simply, what I'll show you here is looking at what happens when you stick a protein in there, how it deforms the bilayer locally around that inclusion. And so to us, at this level of modeling, a membrane-bound protein, transmembrane protein, is going to be something that's relatively rigid and that is attracted to sit in the bilayer. And the way that we do that in simplest form is we make something that looks like a coffee can here, and we make the pieces of it out of the same beads that the lipids are made of so that it's attractive and wants to stick in there. And because if you count the number of beads here, you've actually got the same number of beads from interface to interface as if you took two lipids and stuck them directly into him. So, but that's in a rigid geometry. So what happens then is that this thing's actually a little bit thicker than the bilayer wants to be. You have this hydrophobic mismatch, and the bilayer, so this is a cartoon, and there's not a void here, but just for emphasis, I've drawn it that way. The bilayer is going to splay open a little bit to adjust to that locally. Okay, and so the simulation results, where we actually look at this, are shown here. So the circles are actually looking at the data. So what we're plotting is the percent dilation of the bilayer. So it starts off 8% dilated because of this hydrophobic mismatch. And as you walk away from the center of the protein, further and further away, it eventually heals itself over around the 10 nanometer mark. Maybe the most interesting feature of this plot is the fact that the membrane, actually the bilayer, overcorrects itself before it gets back to equilibrium. So you've actually got the bilayer being thinner than it wants to be before it gets back to being flat. This is a prediction that was actually made by Phil and Sam Safran and Neely Don, and actually the first author is the only one I don't know. But they predicted this theoretically on the basis of elasticity theory. And the fit to that theory, you can see here, is essentially it's perfect. Okay. So I think depending on your point of view, you can either take this as a null result and that, you know, we were silly to run the simulation, or I think the more positive spin to put on this is that, you know, it's sort of interesting that elasticity theory works this well over length scales that are, you know, quite short, only a few lipids. And actually, Phil, when we talked to him about this, and Sam and Neely Don, you know, they all were, I think, pleasantly surprised, but surprised nonetheless that it actually worked as well, the theory worked as well as it does.
And just confused with the points out of the simulation.
Yes, yes. So the points of the simulation and the line is the fit.
But they're not parameters yet.
No, so yes. Let me say, so okay, calling this a fit is misleading, and in the sense that we know what goes into that model, that elastic model, and there's really three, if you want to call them fit constants in there, formed from combinations of these elastic and geometric properties of the bilayer. And the point is that you can get at these numbers by running the simulation of the bilayer without the protein stuck in there. So you can get at all of these things from running the simulation. the thickness of the bilayer and the area for lipid are sort of trivially available just by looking at the averages. By looking at fluctuations, as Mark has described, you can get at the bending modulus and similarly the stretching modulus of the bilayer. And the spontaneous curvature of the monolayer, which if it's non-zero, says that the lipids actually, if you put oil on one side and water on the other, would actually have a tendency to cup up and make a micelle if it's a positive number. You can get at that by actually analyzing the stress profile, which I showed you, this thing with the peaks and troughs. And so the bottom line is that we can get these numbers from simulation that doesn't have the protein in there, predict them, and to within error bars, they're the same thing as the fits that come out of the deformation profile. So this isn't just us playing a game with fitting this profile to something with a bunch of constants, all right? The elastic stuff works. Okay, so seeing that this elastic model worked really very well in the context of these deformations really encouraged us to see how far we could push it, or actually a similar sort of reasoning for analyzing the fluctuations of homogeneous bilayers. So there's actually been a little bit of literature on this, and I guess in our estimation it wasn't completely satisfactory. So let me state, you know, from this point forward, I'm not going to present any new physical ideas. If you look in the literature, you can find bits and pieces of this everywhere, but we've sort of synthesized it into a picture that we think is describing everything in one theory. And the idea here is we start with sort of simple treatment for the bilayer. We have a surfactant monolayer on the top and bottom, which are described by elasticity theory. We couple them together by requiring volume conservation of the lipid tails, so we're not going to be allowing, you know, voids in here. And additionally, to evaluate fluctuations on sort of this sort of length scale you're seeing here, individual molecules, you have to take into account more microscopic fluctuations than just pure bending theory. And in the literature, this has become known as protrusion modes. The fact that lipids can sort of move relative to one another microscopically with a little bit of atomic level noise. And so there's sort of a complicated looking equation here for our Hamiltonian. What we have are bending fields, these are the z's, protrusion fields, these are the lambdas, which are coupled to the z's, and plus and minus refer to in phase, so undulation of the bilayer, on top of one another, and minuses is this sort of peristaltic motion. And so the top line is just the bending stuff. The middle line is bending, the top line is undulation stuff. The center line is peristaltic, only bending components, and the bottom is the peristaltic contribution to, the protrusion contribution to the peristaltic modes. So the most interesting piece we have in here, which is something nobody had previously considered in this context, was these pieces with the spontaneous curvature, which again we have this idea from Phil's theory that this might be a good idea to include these if we want to interpret how bilayers are fluctuating in time. But it also leads to this contribution being more complicated. And all the pieces in here, right, we start with just elastic properties of the individual monolayers, and then they add together in phase or out of phase and give the elastic properties of the bilayer, so undulations here, peristaltic here. Okay, so probably nobody's familiar with the literature, but I'll just say that there's sort of a number of advantages to the way that we've been thinking about this, I believe, as opposed to what's out there currently to analyze these things. And additionally, we're able to apply exactly the same theory to this hydrophobic mismatch. It's a little bit modified from what Phil did, but not sort of significantly enough to comment. Okay, so this is the data. So what we have here is simulation data from three different molecular dynamics simulations in the literature, the only three I'm aware of, where they looked at fluctuations of these bilayers, both undulations, so the in-phase motion of the bilayer, so the whole height of the thing moving up and down, and the peristaltic fluctuations or thickness fluctuations where you looked at the out-of-phase motion, and we're plotting on the x-axis here is the wave vector. Okay, we're in Fourier space. For three different lipids, DPVC, GMO, and sphingomyelin, and our coarse grain models at the bottom, and the blue lines are our fit to this using the theory. So there are five fit constants for each two of these things taken together. Okay, so that sounds like a lot, but relative to what else has been discussed in the literature, it's the same or less. And in the literature, what people have been doing doesn't give you continuous fits of this data. They draw single lines through the long wavelength regime and the short wavelength regime, and there's a certain level of bulkiness. But you can see that the model we've got actually does a good job of fitting the data, and there was one sort of nice thing I think that came out of this, which is that when you include the spontaneous curvature in looking at these peristaltic fluctuations, you you predict that the following thing might be possible if the numbers are right. It's possible that you have configurations of the bilayer that are actually favored energetically over the bilayer being completely flat, and this is due to the spontaneous curvature of the monolayers for the following reason. So we've got lipids here that are in their preferred curvature and others that are not, okay? And the point is that because of volume conservation of the hydrophobic tails, there end up being more of these guys that are happy because they're stretched out, and these ones here that are unhappy and compressed together, there's less of them. So this actually ends up being a net favorable energetic effect over some sort of sinusoidal deformation or one of the Fourier modes. Okay. So these guys that are unhappy.
Well, what about the elastic part? I mean, that has to work out right.
What elastic part?
Well, the stretching of the tails to fill the volume.
Yeah, well, it's all in there.
It's not obvious that that works out right, does it?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, this doesn't have to be the case if the numbers are wrong. I mean, it's only, okay. But it turns out, if you look at the data, in two of the simulations that were done, you see a manifestation of this, and what happens is that you actually see a rollover as you go to the longer wavelengths. So there's actually a preferred height of fluctuation here, okay? Whereas if there's no spontaneous curvature included in the theory, this should plateau out and just be flat, okay? So, and if you look in the picture, I don't think it's showing up well, but actually the picture that was shown in the publication where they took this data, you can actually even sort of see this. You see what looks like these bulges. And so the authors of this paper attributed this sort of downturn here to incomplete sampling. So they didn't consider the spontaneous curvature should be there. They thought it was wrong. They said, well, we didn't sample enough. They didn't like it. That may be the case. I don't know. But we have, you know, an explanation for why this might actually be real. And it's actually seen in one of the other systems as well. Okay, so I think I'm out of time. I will say that you can test this sort of elastic theory against experiments as well. And I was hoping that Wei Wang would be here because this is very much in the spirit of things he pioneered a long time ago. He's gone, so maybe I'll just skip this, but I mean, we've been able to fit some experimental data as well. So we think this elastic model really is doing a very good job of explaining everything that we've tried to look at. So what would we like to do with this? We'd like to look at interactions between multiple inclusions in the bilayer, and you know, we're sort of running this, but I don't have results such that I'd like to show them at this point.
They are charged or
no? There's no charge in our model. So I think that, you know, this level of implicit solvent modeling, we've shown, and Marcus has as well, that you're able to reproduce an array of bilayer properties and elastic behaviors and sort of mesoscopic level behavior. Computation is obviously a lot simpler than running a fully atomic MD simulation. And this has really motivated us, these sorts of models, to go back and reanalyze some of the elastic theories that are out there. And I think that this then ended up being able to explain some of the MD simulation data. So there's sort of this nice interplay we've had in developing and playing with these coarse grain models that, you know, you're not just necessarily stuck with these coarse grain models, but it enables you to think about experiments and MD simulations and the theory as well. And this is sort of, you know, a nice place in the middle to be able to think like that. So I'll just thank the people that did the work. Lawrence and Grace are two graduate students that have been working on this. Lawrence did the work on the elastic level modeling, and Grace has been working on the molecular level models and the elastic model that I showed you at the end of the talk. And Adele and Peter are two undergraduates that have been helping, at one point or another, did help Grace with some of the simulations. And these people here that have been marginalized with the small font, they're the ones that gave me some of the data I showed you, both the experimental data from Jay and the simulation data from the following groups on spectrum of fluctuations, and these people have provided the money.